From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In Surfside, Florida today, more devastating news for more families. Crews discovered more bodies in the rubble of the condo building collapse of nearly a week ago. 16 people are now confirmed dead, more than 140 others still missing. And the painstaking search and rescue mission continues. Dino Zelkovich is one of the, what we'd say, heroic team members digging through the debris. He's with the Hillsborough County Fire Rescue in the Tampa area, but he's also working as part of Florida's Search and Rescue Task Force 3. Dino, thank you for taking a few minutes from your important work. What's it been like?
So part of it has been, you know, getting on there, removing the rubble piles as much as we can by hand. You're not pulling just rocks. You know, you're pulling children's toys, CPAP machines, mattresses, shoes. You know, that's when it gets real. It's not just the rocks. It's when you get to these personal belongings. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the overwhelming feeling of just knowing that there's potentially 150-some people still in here. Each day goes by, you know, we're locating more and more. Hopefully they'll bring some closure to people because it is, you know, who would expect this, especially in such a beautiful place? It's a disaster, yes, but some of the best, most trained people are out here.
I would imagine it's work, but it's on sacred ground.
Yeah, that was my understanding as well. I wasn't aware of that initially, you know, just not being from this area, but it's a very tight-knit community, and they've been fantastic, especially with the circumstances of, you know, welcoming us in and making sure that we're doing okay, and which is nice. This is definitely a difficult process to go through and see this kind of devastation.
What are you thinking about the news today that the Israeli rescue team says that they have found tunnels, pockets, that everybody's been waiting for areas that might not be pancaked completely but might have areas of oxygen? Now, they haven't, you know, there's been no one found alive.
Yeah,
what do you think about that news? Yeah,
That's great news. That's our goal. We're all hoping and praying that we can find, you know, anybody or anything to bring closure. And they've been a great asset because this is what the Israeli team does every single day. So their knowledge and just their hard work ethic has been incredible to see. And, you know, the camaraderie, I mean, we've become one team from the moment they got here. And you have to understand, we have every single task force in the state of Florida is here. And if you were to walk around, I don't think, besides the numbers on our shirts, you'd be able to tell a difference. One group versus another. But honestly, at this point, none of that matters. It's the same goal. Ultimately,
how much are you worried about your own safety? We heard about one of your, you know, your crew, your team, when the families came to make that terrible journey to see the site. One of the workers fell 25 feet down the mound. I mean, what are you concerned about with your own safety?
Safety is our number one goal. You know, we're all doing the best we can to make sure that we're looking out for each other. This is all hard to walk on. Not necessarily unstable. It's just easy to slip and fall, and there's a lot of heavy, you know, metal and sharp stuff. So that's part of the process of having to just make sure we're taking our time going up there and down, because if we get hurt, then the job's not going to get done.
You're looking down. You're being very careful about what you're sifting through. You're watching out for your safety. Do you ever look up and think, oh, my God, this thing fell?
I mean, how could you not? You know, just looking at this site, it's incredible, you know. Unless you're on the ground floor looking at it from the pile, the pictures don't do it justice. It looks fake, honestly. Just looking at something, knowing that there was such a large building and it's now collapsed into this tiny pile versus a giant 13-story building.
Just a couple last questions. You mentioned all the personal things you're coming across. I'm imagining pictures. A family member that came to the site stepped on something and they looked down and it was a card that had been mailed to his grandmother, you know, right under his foot. Are you saving those things?
Yeah, so any personal belongings that we can identify, you know, with a name or anything that we might think that somebody would want, we are doing our best to get it to a certain location, mark it, so that hopefully whoever's family member can help, you know, identify that. I found some stuff yesterday for a life insurance policy. I'm sure that's helpful to somebody to have, you know, but there's just a lot of personal items that there, you know. Imagine what's in your house and then multiply it by however many units plus 100 more items, you know.
Unimaginable. And last, do you think at all, Dino, are you talking about when does this go from search and rescue to recovery? Or do you not think about that yet?
That's not really what I'm tasked to do. We're going to keep working regardless of the mission. So if that means from search and rescue, human remains, it's going to be the same job. Just make sure that we're safe at what we're doing. Our own department, Hillsborough County Fire Rescue, has trained us to do this exceptionally well. This is our time to do it. And, you know, as this progresses longer and longer, obviously we all know what that means. At the end of the day, we still want to make sure that we can respectfully find these people and make sure that they can get closure. Just thoughts of 9/11 keep ringing through all of our heads of the, you know, utter amount of chaos and just the work that those guys were faced with, you know, in 2001.
And then you go home and I'm sure hug your family.
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal, is to go home and hug our families. But what's keeping us going is there's some families that aren't going to be able to do that. And that's why we're here. Maybe we can provide that opportunity.
Dino Zelkovich with the Hillsborough County Fire and Rescue, part of the Florida Search and Rescue Organization, Task Force 3. Dino, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The demand for therapy has skyrocketed with the pandemic, racial violence, and economic troubles of the past year or so. And in the hardest hit communities, the need has been the greatest. As Judith Kogan reports, a Boston psychologist is helping communities of color heal through a process that has traditionally eluded them.
At a recent virtual meeting, professional Black women in the public health field shared what they'd been told about therapy.
Growing up, I was told that therapy is something for crazy people, and that you should be able to pray to overcome whatever you're going through.
I've heard that therapy's only for rich people.
Rich white people.
My grandmother always said, what happens in this house stays in this house.
Jeff Davis, captain of Boston's Black Men Run, says that for Black men, the message is even more severe.
We're not supposed to have emotions. If you have emotion, you can maybe shed a tear, one tear, solitary tear. You can be really angry, or you can be completely apathetic. Those are your options.
The Boston psychologist Charmaine Jackman is trying to change those perceptions. At the start of 2020, she launched InnoPsych, an online platform whose motto is trying to change the face of therapy. Jackman leads workshops to destigmatize and demystify therapy among communities of color.
Because it can be very mysterious, right? Because it happens behind closed doors.
Shortly after InnoPsych went live, COVID hit. Then the traumas around racial justice. Now, there's a spike in demand for therapists, even among communities of color. Jackman knows that finding the right therapist is key to its success. To that end, InnoPsych has created a national directory of therapists of color. It's important, Jackman says, to have a therapist who understands how you walk in the world.
It takes away that having to explain the unexplainable.
A cultural match also tends to make the relationship feel more trustful.
If you're not going to share what's going on for you in that therapy process, then it's not going to be effective.
Jackman says some platform users have reported that white therapists have committed microaggressions or used the therapy session to unpack their white guilt.
When clients experience that in the therapy space, it doesn't feel emotionally safe. You know, it's almost causing harm in that process.
According to the American Psychological Association, only 13% of therapists are people of color, and only 4% are Black. Requests for their services have outpaced the supply. So Jackman's cultivating a pipeline, encouraging young people of color to enter the field and helping therapists of color, many of whom work for corporations, to open their own practices. Jessica Estelle Huggins, a Black filmmaker who found her therapist through InnoPsych, is optimistic about her generation's openness to therapy.
Millennials are really into breaking generational curses, trying to figure out what it means to live our best lives. A lot of that has to do with being honest and getting dirty about things that are painful. But what do we do to either fix whatever the situation is or learn how to live with it? That's the complicated thing about trauma, is figuring out how to deal with it, dealing with the ebbs and flows of really daily emotions when you're trying to just exist in the world.
Jeff Davis says therapy has helped him unlearn narratives coded to him over time.
Therapy has helped me kind of name the emotions and frankly connect my thoughts and intention with my action and behavior, right? as an African-American Black man in this country, it is a literal threat to my survival if I act out and I'm angry in public.
Psychologist Charmaine Jackman sees hope in the escalating numbers of people of color using the directory. To others, still thinking about it, she's encouraging.
Therapy was not made for us, but it doesn't mean that we can't make it work for us.
And she's nurturing every part of the process to help make it happen. For Here and Now, I'm Judith Kogan.
On the cusp of the 4th of July weekend, January 6th is starting to feel like a long time ago. But that is the day that Democrats and Republicans in the House are focusing on today. Lawmakers will vote on Speaker Nancy Pelosi's plan to create a select committee of 8 Democrats and 5 Republicans to investigate the security failures on Capitol Hill in January and how false claims of election fraud inspired an angry mob to riot that day. Few Republicans are expected to support it, but we have our political strategists to weigh in. Jamal Simmons is a Democrat, and Matt Makoviak is our Republican. Welcome to you both.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure, and as we know, last month Republicans said no to a bipartisan commission that would have investigated the January 6th riot. The other option now, a select committee that would be controlled by Democrats. Matt, start with you. What's your gut telling you about this?
Yeah, I mean, look, the right place for this kind of effort is at the Department of Justice, where the criminal investigations and charges can be brought. And that's why I believe the Justice Department just announced they've had several hundred arrests at this point, including 100 that have led to convictions. If I have the numbers correct on that, it's a significant number. I know that, whatever it is. That's where you get outcomes. This is, I think, going to be political. The fact that it's an 8-5 split in a House that has a 5-seat majority, the smallest since the 1940s for the Democrats, shows you it's fundamentally slanted in their favor. They're going to try to use this to keep Trump in the news, try to hurt Republicans. That's their goal. I don't really believe it's about trying to learn more about January 6th. The way you do that is you use the Justice Department, all the powers they have to identify evidence, to investigate, to bring criminal charges, to put people on the stand, and to get convictions. And that's what the Justice Department is doing.
Jamal, do you agree the Department of Justice is where this work should happen, not a congressional committee?
Well, the Department of Justice is where some of the work is already happening. People are being investigated. People are being brought up on charges. The question also, though, is the House, the very citadel of democracy, as people say, the place that we all look at on our money as the symbol of our government, was attacked by these people. The House has a right to investigate. The Congress has a right to investigate. And Republicans, instead of joining forces to say this is beyond politics, this is something that the country cannot stand to have insurrectionist behavior on the grounds of our Capitol, have decided to play politics and to not participate from the majority leader's perspective in picking a commission. So now Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, is trying to do something that is as fair and balanced as possible. But what she's not going to do is let the people who have been aligned with the insurrectionists stack the deck to try to turn this thing into a circus and a farce. That would be criminal on her behalf.
Jamal, one of the other big questions here is who should be on this select committee. Pelosi has suggested that she might actually name a Republican to the panel. Do you think she should?
Sure, she should. There are some Republicans who've shown that they're responsible. I think it would be good for the country to have a couple of Republicans on the panel to make sure that we are, you know, the Democrats and the government are behaving appropriately. You know, Adam Kinzinger, Liz Cheney, those are the names that are being bounced around the most. It would be important. But we can't let the Republicans put a spin on this, that somehow this is a Democratic problem that is being created. This is a problem that was created by the Republicans who refused to have a 50-50 committee that would investigate an attack on our democracy.
All right, Matt, I'm going to throw it over to you. Who do you think should serve on this panel? One of the names, as we've discussed, as Jamal said, is Liz Cheney. Also, Jim Jordan's name. People are wondering if McCarthy might suggest Jim Jordan sit on the panel. He's a Republican firebrand, a Trump supporter. That would certainly make things more politicized, don't you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, they're going to put firebrands on their side on. So I don't believe in unilateral disarmament. I think you should put the smartest, best people for the job, whoever they are. And that's true on both sides. if it is 8 Democrats and 5 Republicans, that does feel stacked. I mean, Jamal said he was worried we wanted to stack the deck. They have a 5-seat majority out of 435 members in the entire House. If it's 8 Democrats and 5 Republicans, that's a 3-seat majority on a committee of 13 people. That's not reflective of the mathematical and vote makeup of the House. So, look, I do think this thing's going to be a circus. I think pretending it's not is just not realistic. But if there are facts to learn, I want to learn them. And if people have committed crimes that have not been charged, I want them to be charged. Anyone that was engaged in this that can be criminally charged needs to be to the fullest extent of the law.
Do you want to hear from Kevin McCarthy, who had a conversation with the president on the day of the insurrection? Should he be subpoenaed?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I don't think that Pelosi wants to subpoena him because she wants to know what really happened. She wants to subpoena him because she wants to weaken him, because he's almost surely going to be the next Speaker of the House in January 2023. So, look, I think all fact witnesses on both sides of the aisle need to be put under oath in a select committee. I would actually add, and I don't want Jamal to laugh, this is a serious point, Speaker Pelosi needs to be put under the oath as well, and I'll tell you why. There was not adequate security at the Capitol, and that decision was left entirely up to the Speaker. And so we need to understand why the Capitol was not protected. This rally was known about for weeks. The Capitol should have been secure. This is the first time the Capitol has been breached in 150 years. You had members of the House and Senate whose lives were put at risk. And so I do think we need to understand why there was such a security failure as well.
Jamal, was that Nancy Pelosi's responsibility?
Agree with that, Matt, that they should investigate the Capitol Police. Even the Speaker should have to talk about what happened in security preparations. But let's not get sidetracked and blame the woman who has a house and say that she's responsible for the fact somebody broke in it, right? Like, they didn't launch it. What we're finding out now is these members like, you know, Gosar and obviously we've got, you know, MTG and all these Republican members of Congress who are been in league with some of the very people who we know went into the house. We have got to investigate the people who committed the offense, not the people who were trying to defend against the attack.
In just a word, because I want to move on to something else, from both of you, in a word, do you think we will get to the bottom of what happened in this form with a select committee?
I don't think we'll
jump in. I think we'll know things.
No, I don't.
I think we'll know things. I think there will be things that we don't know. It'll take years to find out. Some of the problem is that the fault of this may lie in higher realms than the House is able to get to compel testimony. It may be the President of the United States himself who's at fault.
And we heard Matt say that no, he does not think that this will yield any real answers either. So let's move on to something else. It's related. This week, in excerpts from a forthcoming book by Jonathan Carl at ABC News, we learned that the former Attorney General William Barr said he knew that President Trump's claim that the election was stolen was, I'll say, BS. He used the full term. He also acknowledged launching unofficial investigations of those false election fraud claims to just appease the president. Jamal, your reaction to this news?
Great. Say your truth when, you know, later. But the reality is, though, that Bill Barr enabled Donald Trump for years. Bill Barr was part of the Trump administration's corruption of the Justice Department for a long time. So this particular moment is a nice moment. It does not erase Bill Barr's bad behavior for the time he's been Attorney General.
Matt, what about that? Because in the months leading up to the election, Bill Barr was making unfounded claims about election fraud, about mail-in ballots. In fact, here he is speaking with NPR last June.
There's so many occasions for fraud there that cannot be policed. I think it would be very bad. But one of the things I mentioned was the possibility of counterfeiting.
And Matt, we know that's not true. So do you think Barr really can rehab his image after so many months of promoting that falsehood?
Yeah, I don't think it's about rehabbing his image. I think it's about him telling his story. And, you know, he was not in a place to do that as a sitting attorney general. I mean, this is a time-honored tradition where people leave administrations and they talk about what they saw and they try to write the first draft of history. There's no question. Look, I think Bill Barr is an outstanding public servant. He's been attorney general twice. He's a patriot. I understand that Democrats, you know, don't like a lot of what he did. I understand that entirely. But in this case, I've never said that I believe that the election was stolen. I believe there were irregularities that occurred in some of the battleground states. In Pennsylvania, for example, they violated their own constitution by sending unsolicited mail ballots. Does that mean it was stolen? No. It doesn't mean that. And anyone that's saying that is being irresponsible and trying to undermine faith in our democracy. But I do believe election integrity is a reasonable issue to talk about going forward. We want to make sure legal people can vote as easily as possible and that illegal voters cannot vote. We want to make it as hard to vote illegally as possible. That should be something everyone believes.
It is hard to vote illegally. People do not vote illegally. This is not a problem that occurs in the United States of America. This is something that is made up for political purposes to undermine the election of Democrats.
It is true that the elections are secure, in fact. And Donald Trump, the former president, is very angry about this. In a statement, he said that he lost confidence in Barr long before 2020 in the election. He called him afraid, weak, pathetic. Matt, what is all of this, if anything, do for the former president's grip on his party?
Yeah, look, he's still the most dominant figure in our party. You saw that with the massive rally in Ohio over the weekend. He's about to get involved in some of these primaries, going after the 10 people that voted to impeach him. But his hold on the party is not as strong as it was. And until we understand whether he is running for election again as president of the United States, which I don't think we'll know until at least January 2023, he's going to have a tenuous but still somewhat a strong grip on the Republican Party. And that's something all Republicans got to contend with as we have other people step up to express their interest in running in 2024.
And Jamal, you get the final word here. We have about 40 seconds.
I think Republicans should be afraid. What Americans have decided they don't want is Trump in charge of the government and Trump's allies in charge of the government. That's how he lost the House of Representatives, lost the United States Senate, and lost the White House in the course of 4 years. If I were on their side, I'd want the guy as far away from an election as possible.
Jamal Simmons is a Democratic political strategist, and Matt Mikowiak is our Republican. Thanks very much to both of you. I appreciate it.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
The first podcast series to ever win a Pulitzer Prize, NPR's No Compromise.
We dive into the political movement that's driving extreme gun rights activism and more. I'm Chris Haxel.
And I'm Lisa Hagen. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
And let's get an update now on the conflict in Tigray, that remote region in Ethiopia in the Horn of Africa, where rebels have been fighting government forces in a civil war. The fighting started last November after Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, moved to marginalize the Tigray Liberation Front, the rebels. Thousands have died, and there's a growing humanitarian crisis in the region. The BBC's Kalkadan Yibatal joins us now. He's on Skype from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. Kalkadan, start us off. What do we know about the situation in Tigray today?
After 8 months of fighting and humanitarian crisis in the past 3 days, there seem to be dramatic turns of events. One is that the rebel forces have recaptured the state's capital, Mekelle, and also other cities in the region, in the area. This is one. And the other one is the government here in Addis, in the capital, has declared a unilateral ceasefire. For months, they have been rejecting calls from the international community for the cessation of hostilities and for the ending of this conflict. And now they said, in light of an approaching rainy season, which could impact farmers living in those areas, they have decided to declare a unilateral ceasefire. It's not clear if the rebels have accepted the ceasefire and whether this marks the end of the beginning of the end for the conflict.
To remind people, Prime Minister Ahmed won the Peace Prize for his work to end a civil war with neighboring Eritrea, but he and Eritrea are on the same side in this conflict. Can you just very briefly, in maybe just one sentence, for each side, what is each side saying about the other side? What is each side claiming?
Well, the government, which is backed by, as you said, the Eritrean troops, says that the rebel forces, the TPLF forces, are working to destabilize the country because they have lost their dominance that they had for three decades. While the rebel forces are accusing the prime minister of attempting to stay in power illegally and unconstitutionally to, you know, maintain his power.
We see Ethiopians in the diaspora, you know, people living here in the United States, constantly having protests, trying to raise awareness about this, and the thousands of people who are affected by it. Beyond the deaths, the U.S. is warning that nearly a million people face famine conditions. But as we understand it, roads are blocked, groups can't get in, aid groups.
Yes, there are some areas that are easily accessible by aid agencies, and they're providing aids. And the government is also saying that they're providing 70% of all the aids that are all the aid that's delivered so far. But, you know, this is a mountainous area, an arid area that witnessed continuous fighting for 8 months, and particularly those remote areas that have seen continuous fighting. They were not accessible by aid agencies, which means hundreds of thousands of people caught in the crossfire, trapped in those areas, are in an immediate danger. In an immediate danger because, you know, they're not aid is not reaching to them. So the US and the UN and other European countries are warning that unless there is immediate and drastic measure to reach those people, things could go from bad to worse.
That's the BBC's Kalkadan Ibeltal speaking with us from Addis Ababa. Kalkadan, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
It is a little cooler today in Oregon and Washington State, thank goodness, after a heat dome baked the Pacific Northwest with triple-digit temperatures for several days in a row. Now, as many as a dozen deaths may be tied to that heat. And those deaths worry people who organize support services for the homeless community, including Jimmy Jones. He's executive director of the Mid-Willamette Valley Community Action Agency in Salem, Oregon. His team has been out distributing water and arranging medical transports for people who've been living outside. Jimmy, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. It's good to be here.
Salem hit 117 degrees on Monday. First of all, just what was that like? Have you ever felt anything like it before?
Well, for this particular area where you have an average high temperature of about 81, 82 degrees in this time of June, it was a very shocking event. And especially since, you know, so many folks in the Pacific Northwest do not have air conditioning like households in the rest of the country. So this was a devastating event for a lot of people who aren't used to this kind of heat.
Well, in fact, it is dangerous, right? I mean, the National Weather Service said that it's now the highest recorded temperature west of the Cascades in the Pacific Northwest. How did your community experience that heat?
So it was a very difficult moment in a lot of different ways. To kind of turn back the clock a little bit, we've been through a series of just really trying moments over the course of the last 18 months. Like everyone else, we've been dealing with the COVID crisis here in Oregon. But, you know, in addition to that, you know, we had in our community here in Marion County, we had the Labor Day fires over in early September, which devastated eastern Marion County, especially the Santiam Canyon area. And then in February, just 4 months ago, we had the worst ice storm in living memory for everyone. 70% of Marion County lost power for up to a week. And many of our homeless population here are chronically homeless. They've been homeless for quite some time. They have associated disabling conditions, quite frequently physical health conditions. And, you know, we have just been through this year in which we've had an enormous number of people pass away. Some passed away outside, some passed away because they got struck by a vehicle, some passed away from drug overdoses, some passed away from medical conditions in the hospital. We lost about 30 in the last year, which is about twice the normal number of folks that we lose. So adding this moment on top of all of those was incredibly difficult for our community. Folks are reticent to come into cooling centers. They don't want to leave their encampments because they're afraid that their property may be stolen or someone may tear up their tent. So, you know, they tend to wait a little bit too long sometimes. And we had quite a few heat-related medical problems. A couple people passed away in a neighboring community. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like this was just the latest in a string of very difficult things that have happened to your community there. But how did you prepare? You know, I see that you opened up 9 cooling centers around the city. You distributed almost 3,600 bottles of water, 1,000 pounds of ice. I mean, were you ready for what was coming?
Well, we're never really ready for events like this because the forewarning is often very short in time. But our deployment was actually really good given the short notice that we had.
You mentioned some deaths because of this heat. Tell me what you know about those and how they happened.
Well, in a neighboring town, Bend, Oregon, and it's a couple hours east of here, they had a couple of deaths there that were believed to be heat-related. Of course, it's sometimes hard to, you know, to discern what the actual situation was this quickly. They're being investigated. We had a farm worker death in a small town called St. Paul, not far from here. We had 6 people that we interacted with alone in the homeless community that we arranged for medical transport because they were in a state of distress from the environmental conditions. And then we have one report of one homeless individual living over here near the interstate who did pass away. I'm a little bit hesitant to talk too much about that because I don't have all the details. And a lot of times in the homeless community, information travels by word of mouth, so sometimes the context is lost. So I need to investigate that a little bit more before I could say with any degree of certainty what happened there.
Understanding how dangerous the heat is when it descends on a place for several days in a row, was there a sense of dread among people who didn't have shelter that this was coming and it was going to be bad?
There was a sense of dread. A lot of times people don't take it seriously until it gets to be, you know, a very dangerous situation. So we saw a little bit of that, people having some reticence to come into cooling centers. We've been running cooling centers out here for about 4 years now, and they are always undersubscribed. People generally don't come to them unless they are in a state of real distress. We have a river that runs through the middle of Salem, and a lot of people go down to the river to get into the water and get cool. So that's always been one of the common coping mechanisms and strategies that the homeless population has when it comes to extreme weather events.
Your governor, Kate Brown, recently signed a bill that would require tracking the deaths of people who are homeless, and it would have to be noted on the death certificate if they didn't have shelter at the time of their death. How important is a bill like that, and what would it do to help situations like this?
Well, it's very important, and it's one that I worked on quite consistently. There's just so much information out there that we don't have and so much information that the public doesn't have about the consequences of living in these unsheltered environments. And, you know, without that information, it's really easy to ignore this. It's real convenient to ignore this because that information sort of compels action. It suggests responsibility, and it encourages people to do something about this just insufferable human condition that people are quite frequently living in outside. And I hope that it will lead to better social service outcomes down the road.
I'm hearing what you're telling me about the deaths that you've experienced there in your community, about the heat wave that just came. You also mentioned the fires that have caused major problems in your area, and they have across the West. They're just getting worse. Do you also worry about the way a warming climate and climate change will be affecting people who are living without permanent shelter?
Oh, absolutely, because generally when you look around the world at what the consequences of global warming have been already, the populations that are being impacted the most and the first are the people in abject poverty, the people without adequate shelter, the people without adequate medical care, the people without the ability to seek safe shelter. And as our situation in the West, as most of your listeners will know, has just deteriorated in terms of the fires over the last 20 years, it is getting to be a graver and graver concern every year. I was just in a meeting with the Department of Human Services yesterday, and we were having conversations about what our plans are going to be for the upcoming fire season. You know, these kinds of events that we're talking about here, added on top of that, we can have very devastating consequences.
I can tell you're the kind of guy who cares about other people as much or more than yourself. And it's been a pretty tough year for everybody. How are you holding up? I mean, how are you doing?
Well, we're doing okay. You know, when you get into this work, there are a lot of different reactions to it. Some people care so much that after you see the kinds of human suffering that we see on a fairly regular basis, a lot of people just get burned out and they leave the work, they leave the profession, and they just can't take one more death. They can't take one more tragedy. They can't take one more story about the suffering that people experience in these unsheltered conditions. The other danger is, you know, you've lived through so much of it, you become kind of callous to it. You struggle to find empathy. And so to be able to stay in the work long term, you have to find a balance between those two extremes to kind of keep going. This has, without a doubt, been the most difficult year of all of our lives doing this work between COVID and, you know, a lot of our clients didn't end up getting the virus in Oregon. Because in part, we have so many unsheltered people living outside in a perfectly socially distanced environment. But at the same time, so many services got shut down and reduced. Access to medical care was more difficult. We operate day centers, and normal capacity in a day center is around 80 people. Well, we had to drop that to 10 at one point in time, and eventually it came back up to 20 and 25 and now 30. And now, as of today, the governor has ended the emergency order here in Oregon, and, you know, basically the state is reopened. So we'll get back to a 100% capacity there. But COVID made everything so much harder. But then on top of that, we had the Labor Day fires. We had this terrible ice storm and a fairly rough winter overall. And then just, you know, 4 months later, where the sun is baking us off the surface of the earth. So this has been a really challenging 18 months, without a doubt.
Wow. Jimmy Jones, executive director of the Mid-Willamette Valley Community Action Agency in Salem, Oregon. Hang in there, and thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here today.
The NCAA is expected to approve a plan today that would allow college athletes to make money from the use of their name, image, and likeness. This has been prohibited by NCAA rules, but now the organization is trying to reform those rules, especially after the recent Supreme Court ruling that weakened the NCAA's, the long-held notion of amateurism in college sports. The timing for today's meeting is important because tomorrow a handful of state laws legalizing similar compensation take effect. So let's bring in NPR's sports correspondent, Tom Goldman. He's tracking this story. Tom, I always feel like we should have some big music to enter you in, but welcome.
Well, especially today, Robin, because this is a new day dawning. So we should cue the new day dawning music.
It is. It's such a big deal. Remind us what we're talking about. There's an acronym, NIL, Name, Image, and Likeness. College athletes will be able to earn money from third parties, not the school. So remind us how it's going to work.
Well, starting tomorrow, July 1st, college athletes can earn that third-party money in a number of ways. Endorsement deals, speaking engagements, autograph signings, sports camps and group or individual lessons, social media content. That's probably the easiest because most young people have phones and access to Instagram and Twitter and YouTube, and now athletes can monetize what they do on social media. It does seem like the floodgates will open. There's still a ton of confusion among athletes about how to do this. Businesses are springing up, offering help. And it's not exactly the Wild West of earning cash here, Robin. There still are restrictions. The NCAA is preserving its prohibition on pay for play. And there are other do's and don'ts, such as NIL compensation can't be tied to athletic performance, meaning a company can't offer you more money if you score a certain number of points.
Ah, so it can't somehow interfere with a performance which gets you into the betting world, you know, when you're doing that, paying someone for that. But we mentioned, you know, some states are ready to implement laws. So what's happening? Is the NCAA playing catch up?
It really is. I mean, it's been mulling and discussing NIL since 2019, at least. That's when California passed the first NIL law. And it struck fear in the NCAA because, number one, it represented loosening the purse strings, which the NCAA didn't want to do. The whole system of college athletics was built on, you know, this notion of amateurism and athletes being content with scholarships and not getting a piece of the growing economic pie. And then the NCAA was worried about a state-by-state approach to NIL and how that would create a competitive imbalance by allowing schools in the states with NIL laws to have a recruiting advantage for athletes. But the NCAA couldn't pull the trigger on a broad nationwide rule, and so states went forward, and that forced the NCAA's hand. It hastily came up with this interim plan that's being voted on today, which, as you said, is expected to be approved.
Yeah. Again, NIL, name, image, and likeness. We're going to get used to that. Just quickly, will there be a conflict between state laws and the NCAA?
There won't. The NCAA plan says for athletes in states where there is an NIL law, follow that law. The NCAA plan says for states without a law, schools and conferences can create their own policies.
Yeah. Now, critics have long looked at this and at the NCAA's and said these are not amateur athletes, except in the fact that they're not making any money. You know, the schools and the organizations made so much money off them. So this is the sea change that, you know, you say it is. What are you hearing from athletes?
You know, athletes are very aware of this new day dawning. They're a bit confused, as I mentioned, but also excited to have the opportunity not only to make money, but to have the experience of doing business and building their personal brands, which are, you know, good skills to have, certainly after college. Here are a couple athletes I talked to. New Mexico State sophomore basketball player Molly Kaiser says it's amazing that athletes will finally benefit from their name, image, and likeness. And it's appropriate, she says, since they work hard to get their name out there.
I'm honored to be like a part of the start of that. So I think it's going to be pretty cool. And now I can continue to make YouTube videos and actually profit off of it.
Yeah, and I also talked to University of Michigan basketball player Naz Hillman. Now, Michigan's state law isn't scheduled to start until December of next year. If she takes an extra year of eligibility that the NCAA is offering because of the pandemic, she will be playing then and be able to take advantage of NIL. She told me she'd like to do some basketball camps and would promote her friends and families.
Some of them have businesses, and I'm technically not allowed to promote them and say, go visit them. And, you know, I have to word it a certain way on my social medias.
Well, so a lot of joy there, we're hearing, Tom. But are there people that, you know, you respect who are concerned about this?
Concerned? I haven't heard a lot of concern. I think there's a general feeling that this is long overdue, that as this, as the money in big time college sports has grown and athletes haven't been able to take advantage of that, they've been prevented from taking advantage of that. This is a step toward finally being able to, and not just the athletes in the big revenue generating sports, but a lot of the athletes in non-generating sports, the minor, so-called minor sports, yeah, for whom, you know, college is the end of the line for competitive reasons, so this is their time to take advantage.
Like maybe lacrosse or soccer. NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
A new day dawning. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here Now.